K-12 Education Finance Committee will come to order. The first bill that we have up on the agenda, well, see, we've got a quorum, so let's go ahead and get our minutes out of the way so that my legislative assistant won't be getting upset with me. The minutes for March 4th, Representative Goodwin, would you like to move them?
Yes, ma'am. Chair, I move the minutes.
Are there any additions or corrections? If not, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposition? The minutes of March 4th are approved. With one opposition.
Madam Chair, who just approved the minutes?
We all did, I thought.
No, I mean, who moved the who moved?
Oh, Representative Goodwin moved the minutes.
We probably shouldn't move minutes if we weren't in attendance.
Well,
no, and I'm not criticizing Representative Goodwin. I just know that it happens sometimes that I'm called on
okay.
to approve to move the motion, and I haven't been in attendance. And I feel that I really can't do that if I wasn't there.
Well, but I think minutes are a little bit different than other issues.
Okay.
But I will try to observe that, make sure that that doesn't happen again. Representative Sikora, would you like to come forward and present your bill?
Please, thank you. Madam Chair, I would like to move House File 581. To be looked at and held up for consideration in the omnibus finance bill.
So moved.
And also, I have an amendment, which kind of brings all the amendment does, even though it's kind of long. It's 581A1. What it really does is just brings it up to date for this year. This bill was introduced last year, and so the dates are. The dates would have applied last year.
All right.
The amendment makes. The dates apply for this year. So I'd like to move my amendment to A1.
All right. Are there any questions about the amendment? If not, all in favor of the A1 amendment, say aye.
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 Opposition?
Aye.
The A1 amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, what this bill is a bill that creates an education price index that recognizes the cost of providing an education, of hiring the people that you need to hire, et cetera, in order to provide an education in various parts of the state. And it defines the education price index for each school district as equal to 1, or the greater of 1, whichever it ends up being. You know, if you look at the way we finance education, we find that we recognize all sorts of issues around the state. So we have a multitude of formulas that address specific issues that try to make sure that we create as much equality as possible. So over time, the way we've addressed this is with differences. We have something called sparsity aid, sparsity transportation, declining enrollment aid, equity aid, LEP, compensatory, and so on. One of the more obvious areas that, in my opinion, has been overlooked is the difference in the cost of providing an education depending on where you are in the state. The Department of Economic Security has already established regions in the state, and they vary depending on salaries, the cost of services, and hiring people to provide services, et cetera. And in those areas, we find that the cost of providing various services, et cetera, in the state can vary anywhere from up to 15% or 20%. So, you know, when you look at a district who's trying to hire people, teachers, bus drivers, clerks, paraprofessionals, and so on, the cost of hiring somebody like that varies a great deal. My sister worked as a paraprofessional in the schools, as did my sister-in-law, and she is in she was in the small town where I grew up, and I think she was making $7 an hour, whereas I know at that time I checked with my district and they were paying $9 or $10 an hour. So there are differences in the cost of providing certain services. This bill would try to add to the formula one more piece, which would recognize cost of providing an education. And we have some people here very well qualified to address this. Tom Berge, who is considered the best expert on the cost of education and how these crazy formulas work in the state of Minnesota, and Scott Kroonquist from AMSD, and then I have a couple of superintendents who will comment later. And we have a little sound and light show for you.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Scott Kroonquist with the Association of Metropolitan School Districts, and we do have a handout, too, if we could have some help. We are here today to support the Representative Sikora's bill, House File 581, and as she outlined, what this bill does is would allow the basic education formula to recognize a legitimate, a cost difference that exists out there for school districts across the state. What it does not do, and what this bill is not an attempt to do, is to take money from any other district in the state. It's not an attempt to redistribute money. It's not saying that some districts get too much money. What it is saying, though, is that we're not currently recognizing a cost driver in the that we face just because of our market conditions. I'm going to just take you through, Madam Chair, through a PowerPoint presentation. Basically, this is focused on the higher wages that are prevalent, especially in the metropolitan area, but not limited to the metro area. If you look across the state of Minnesota, wage scales do change from region to region. Here is a map that shows the metropolitan statistical areas in the state. This is what the Census Bureau uses when they do comparisons, and so that's what our data is based on. If you look at a whole wide variety of occupations in the state of Minnesota, and then look at what the average hourly wage is in each region, you can see the differences that do exist. And these are all non-education-related jobs. As you can see, if you look down the column under Twin Cities, you can see that in virtually every job category, the highest wages are in the metropolitan area. Although it is not only that, you can see if you look at Rochester and some of the regional centers, they also have higher wages in those areas than in other parts of the state. So it should not be a surprise that, in fact, education experiences the same situation. If we look at average teacher salaries based on 2003 data, you can see that, again, in the Twin Cities metropolitan area, the average teacher salary is significantly higher. In just a little different way of looking at that and putting some of the exact figures in, Region 11 at the top there is the Twin Cities metropolitan region. You can see that the average teacher salary is almost $44,000 as compared to other parts of the state where it's, in some cases, under $37,000. Why are labor costs higher in the metro area? Well, one significant reason has to do with housing costs. And here you can see the average estimated market value for single-family homes by school district. And this map, not surprisingly, looks a lot like the average teacher salary map. As you can see, average housing costs in the Twin Cities area, again, are significantly higher than they are in other parts of the state. Here's that same information, but giving you the exact figures and showing it in a little different format. Again, Region 11 at the top here is the Twin Cities metropolitan region. So the next step we took was we combined those last two sets of data, the average teacher salary and then the average cost of housing. And we computed what percent of the average teacher salary would it take to afford the average price home in that district or in that region. And so this map again looks similar to the last one. You can see that in the Twin Cities metropolitan area, it takes a significantly higher percent of the average teacher's salary to afford the average price home in that region. Here's the data again giving you the exact figures. If you go on the far right, you can see that in the metropolitan area, it takes almost 29% of the average teacher's salary to afford the average price home. And now this is actually probably understating it because this is based on principal and interest only, so it would not take into account property taxes, which, as you know, are also a function of the value of the home. If we look at rental rates as opposed to mortgage rates and home ownership, the story does not change. In fact, it's a very similar layout in the map. Again, higher rental rates in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. In the current funding formula, this higher cost of doing business is not recognized. Here's the 2004 general education revenue broken down by these are the stratums that the Department of Education uses. They break down the Greater Minnesota districts by enrollment, and then the metro districts, and then Minneapolis and St. Paul. Of course, the big red bar at the bottom is the basic formula allowance. So that's the 4601 that every student gets. And if we take that away, then, and just look at the various categoricals, you can see that we do recognize a lot of the different costs associated with providing education. And these are all very legitimate cost differentials that are very appropriately recognized. We have compensatory revenue, LEP, sparsity, transportation sparsity. These are all in place because they recognize that they are addressing a legitimate cost of business difference. But the one that is not on this chart, you will note, is that there is no place where we recognize that higher labor costs in various parts of the states, especially in the Twin Cities metropolitan area. In fact, if you notice, the highest, the biggest chunk in the other metro district category is the referendum levy. And so really, by and large, what those larger operating referendums are being used for in the suburbs are to pay those higher labor costs. But that is putting a lot of pressure on property taxpayers. As you can see in the metro area districts, over 87% of those operating referendums then do fall on the local property taxpayers, with only 12.6% coming from the state in the form of equalization. Even with those higher operating referendums, you can see that if we rank our 26 member districts in terms of total revenue, which is the second column, so this would be the total rank for total revenue out of all 343 school districts, you can see that by and large they do not rank near the top in terms of total revenue. Now if you move over a couple columns and look at the rank for total aid, this is what you would arrive at then if you subtract out the levy portion of the operating referendum. And here, then, you'll notice, of course, that our member districts rank near the bottom, in fact, in terms of total aid received. So just kind of a summary, then, of how this plays out. You can see the average teacher salary in the metro area districts and in Minneapolis, St. Paul are significantly higher, but not nearly high enough to compensate for the higher housing costs. And that's put a lot of pressure on school district budgets. One result is that we have higher class sizes in the metro area and much lower fund balances. And so with that, Madam Chair and committee members, I would turn it over to Tom Berge, who will give you a little more specific information about how that impacts a certain set of districts, including his district and some of the neighboring districts to Minnetonka.
Thank you. Mr. Berge?
Madam Chair, committee members. Get this set up. Thank you. Just as an introductory comment, I have to respond to Representative Sikora's very generous compliment of my knowledge in regard to school funding. It reminded me of a experience I had with a similar committee a number of years ago. I believe Representative Byerly was chairing that committee, and I offered the comment that a professor at the University of Minnesota who teaches school finance had observed that he did not believe there was one person in the state of Minnesota who understood school funding from the point that an assessment was made on a piece of property until that money was finally collected and recorded as revenue. And Representative Byerly took exception with that, saying he thought maybe there were three or four people who understood. So it's a complicated issue. What I'd like to touch on this morning, and Mr. Kroonquist focused on the difference in costs to live in the Twin Cities metro area and the impact on wages. And I want to touch briefly on what has been happening with school funding, its impact on the services that that we have been able to provide, and take a look at what we're looking at for recommendations. And I have a handout as well. Basically, what I want to take a look at is kind of a multi-year trend of state funding of education, the 10-year comparison of the metros, looking at the document, the difference that were just referenced, and the impact on staffing and resources at the district level. As we take a look at where we are right now, if we adjust for inflation, the state average per pupil operating revenue is relatively flat. Then if you take a look at the West Metro as compared to the state average, we're well below state average. As a result, metro area districts are being squeezed, and we're facing the challenge of how we continue to provide quality education services with basically diminishing resources. These next two charts I lifted from a presentation that was made by Tim Strom to the School Board Association training seminar for new board members. And in the first chart, basically, we're looking at the impact of growth in state funding. The top line reflects the actual growth in per pupil funding. The second line is adjusted downward, taking out a portion of cost that deals with debt service, and the final line deals with taking out both debt service and special education. If you adjust for inflation, the inflation-adjusted cost after taking out special ed and facility costs is essentially flat over the last probably even going back 10 years. If we take a look at what has been happening in the West Metro area, we've been dealing with a situation where referendum levies are capped, didn't benefit from compensatory revenue, do not benefit from sparsity revenue, did not benefit from the $415 transfer. And the bottom line is that the West Metro districts, and for that matter many metro districts, have not been the benefit of these frequent changes. West Metro districts, we're looking at Minnetonka, Wayzata, Hopkins, Orono, Edina, St. Louis Park, and Eden Prairie. And this is sometimes affectionately referred to by people as the Gold Coast. And I just want to say that we've not been the beneficiary of the goal in terms of what has been happening with the funding formulas. The stereotype is wealthy, high spending, low pupil staff ratios, and referendums pass easily. The reality is that our 10-year increase in spending is two-thirds of the state average. That's resulted in a rank of per pupil spending decreasing significantly for every West Metro district. As a result, when we took a look at the 2002 school profiles, our per pupil spending is not that much different from the state average. Bottom line is our staffing ratios now are well above state average. In terms of referendums, they're a definite challenge to pass. In our district, we, over the last 10 years, have had to run referendums twice. The first time it's failed, the second time through very, very extended effort on the part of parents, the community were able to pass the referendums. when we take a look at what's been happening with expenditure rankings in 91-92, the West Metro districts as compared to 02-01-02 have all dropped. In Minnetonka, our ranking has dropped from 45th in the state to 86th in the state. On the bottom side in Eden Prairie is down to 103rd. The top one is St. Louis Park, and they have dropped. The in terms of just averaging the per pupil expenditures, the average for this group of districts would have dropped from 37th to 64th. In terms of actual changes in expenditures, the average for this group increased by about 45% over this 10-year period, whereas the state average increased by 64%. And a fairly good amount of this increase dealt with the categorical funding for things like reduced class size and staff development and compensatory funding and all of those kinds of things. They were basically categorical, and some of those items West Metro districts were not beneficiaries of. Basically, what it comes down to is that the increase over that 10-year period of time is $470 below the state average. In 91-92, the West Metro districts were able to expend 20% more than the state average. Now it's down to 6% more than the state average. And the bottom line for West Metro districts really comes down to teacher staffing. That currently, as of 2002, the staffing ratios in non-metro districts are about 8.5% higher than they are in the West Metro districts. Operationally, the cost of equity is higher in the metro districts, as pointed out by Mr. Kroonquist and noted by Representative Sikora in her introductory comments. Personnel costs are higher. Higher personnel costs result in above-average operating costs, and as I noted, the bottom line impacts staffing. If we take a look at the actual differentials, and this is based upon the 2000 data on the Minnesota Department of Economic Security webpage, for school-related positions, it's about an 18% difference. For non-school-related positions, it's about a 32% differential. So just excluding school jobs, looking at private sector, the difference in terms of what private sector employees typically make in the same jobs is on the average about 32% more in the metro area. Expanding the comparison from West Metro to just non-metro and just focusing on districts of similar size, and I took a look, and this was also based upon the 2002 profiles data, identified non-metro districts of 2,500 students or more and compared that to metro districts of 25 students or more, excluding Minneapolis and St. Paul, and metro is defined as the seven county area. And basically it turned out to be 36 districts in each group. In terms of pupils per professional staff, the metro have more pupils for professional staff, about 7.4% more. In terms of instructional staff, about 8.2% more. When it comes down to per pupil expenditures, there's only a 2% differential between the two. They're basically very close at this particular point in time. If you take a look at fund balance, the non-metro fund balances, as Mr. Kroonquist noted, are above that of the metro districts, about 16% higher. You look at where the funding is coming from, and I know some of this has changed since 2002, but at that particular point in time, the non-metro districts were funded at 65% as compared to metro at 53%. In terms of equity, equity has been looked at as equal dollars, but we believe that funding should recognize the cost of equity and educational opportunity, and that equity will vary from region to region of the state. That equal educational opportunity does cost different amounts. In terms of the impact beyond the metro area, it does go to areas such as Rochester, St. Cloud, and Duluth. They, too, are dealing with some of these same issues. And finally, bottom line, there is a documented difference in the cost to operate schools. Basically, it deals with wages. And if you take a look at metro districts, they're basically underfunded when you take a look at comparison of staffing versus funding. And bottom line, we're looking for a funding vehicle that recognizes instructional equity for students requires different levels of funding. We believe incorporating this variable in the formula is important. And the last item is just an editorial item. It's not in the law, but you know, short of dealing with the market-based difference, taking a look at removing operating referendum caps at least is one way of addressing this. So with those comments, I'll turn it back to Representative Socorro, who I believe has a couple of more gentlemen.
Yes, we have two superintendents with us this morning.
All right.
Would you please come up, gentlemen? Go ahead and introduce yourselves.
Hi, good morning, Chairman and representatives. My name is Ken Dreitzeth. I'm Superintendent of Edina Public Schools.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dennis Peterson, Superintendent of Minnetonka School District. We're here today to speak in more general terms about the philosophy of that's embodied in House File 581. I'm here to speak on behalf of that bill and to encourage you to support it. The data you've just seen from a statewide perspective, as well as looking specifically at the impact on districts in part of the metro, has been compelling in my view. Certainly the legislature needs to look at a general principle of providing equal dollars to organizations and individuals throughout the state, unless there's a compelling reason to make them different than equal. I think the legislature over the years has found those compelling reasons, and Representative Socorro has listed many of them. I'm not going to go back over that entire list, but there are reasons to seek equity versus equality in order to find equality of educational opportunity. The end result should be an equality of educational opportunity for all children across our state. And I think treating unequals as equal, as we're doing now with regard to regional cost differences, tends to be unfair to students. Districts are the way we deliver those services, but certainly we're always talking about the impact on students. So when we get a dollar from all of the sources, it's not the same dollar that an outstate district will get, because our dollar won't go as far. Our costs for many of the basic elements in that budget are much higher than they are for outstate districts, and so the regional cost differences is a way to begin to address that serious inequity in our formula. As Mr. Berge has pointed out, there's been a tremendous impact on high-quality districts. Our funding has remained basically flat when you adjust for inflation, when you adjust for special education, and any capital-type funding. We've had our employees face a higher cost of living, as you saw in the Scott Krumquist material, and we've had to address those issues under the law that's been established by the legislature in terms of bargaining. We've cut a lot of our budget. In fact, we're facing a shortfall this year of over $2 million after just passing a referendum and doing a lot of other cost containment. So our programs and services to students are being hurt during this time and will be hurt during the coming school year. We've and as I pointed out, we did pass a referendum finally in 2002. It was not easy. The idea that they pass easily in all of the West Metro is fiction, because we really had to work very hard to do that. And finally, the impact on our taxpayers is more substantial as we have to try to pass referendums, as we go out to raise funds through private donations and essentially any way we can to try to make up for the shortfall in state funding that's been occurring over the last decade. If you look at the Tom Berge data, with about a 20% differential at the beginning of that decade being shrunk down over the past decade, we had it about right at the beginning of the decade. We maybe didn't have it right for the right reasons, because we weren't recognizing cost differentials as that formula. But we've now, in our effort to try to get more equality, if you will, in funding, we've lost a lot of the equity that existed just a decade ago. So I'll be happy to answer questions. I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Dykstra first.
Thank you, Dr. Peterson. I'll just add a few comments and then we'll open for questions. I think one of the things that I personally was involved in over the last year as president of MASA was bringing together the various organizations in the state of Minnesota, MIAC, AMSD, Lake Superior Consortium of Districts, urban districts, and saying we really need to look at this funding issue, and that we really need to look at issues that are statewide, and trying to support them in various ways, and so that we're not so splintered and combative, let's say, among the organizations as it relates to educational finance. And one of the things that we strongly supported was the whole issue of equity. And we have personally, as AMSD, but also personally myself, and also within our district of Edina, have stood up and said that there ought to be equity in funding. And you've done a lot of work in the equity area in terms of tax support within your communities, and a lot of that has not affected districts like ours, but we thought that that was a realistic, fair way to look at some educational funding around the state. So we come here sort of, and this discussion has certainly occurred among those organizations that I put together last year. We come here saying that, you know, the cost differential is a missing piece of the puzzle, that there is a as you've got a lot of data you've heard in the last half hour about that, but it is directly affecting how we deliver services in those districts that have high costs, whether they be in large urban centers or in regional centers. The idea of revenue has also not kept up. In our district, for example, I think there's this common perception that we are a wealthy district and we have a lot of money to fund our education. Edina, fiscal year 2003, received $5,977 total dollars from state and local referendum. That placed us 77th in the state in revenue for us to run our program. There are, at that time, there were six districts that received over $8,000 per pupil in the state of Minnesota. There are another 12 districts that received over $7,000 per revenue, and another 42 districts that received over $6,000 in total revenue. So what you have in this idea that somehow and Minnetonka was rated 50th at that time, and most of the western suburban districts going down to Eden Prairie at 139, Orono at 158, Wayzata 135th in revenue to run our program, both including both state aid and local referendum. So when the issue comes that you have enough, and the cost differentials don't make a difference. So when we put ourselves at 78th, and then you take a 15 to 20% cost differential for doing business in the metropolitan area, that number continues to go way down. And yet I think we're still trying to deliver a quality education just as every other community in the state of Minnesota. The other issue in terms of are we a burden on the state, Edina and Minnetonka ranked last in the state of 343 districts in terms of money that actually comes from the state to fund education. We are dead last in the state in terms of getting money from the state to run our education. So that would indicate why we have referendums. And the referendum, that 20% differential in our district that is made up by referendum, basically covers the cost of doing business in the Twin Cities. At the same time, we're still down in the long ways down the list in terms of revenue that comes to the state. So as a kind of a final piece of the funding puzzle as we go forward, we think that the differential, cost differentials due to living in high-cost areas would be a piece that must be considered as we move forward in education funding in the state of Minnesota to equalize and to put in equity among school districts.
Thank you, Superintendent Drexa. Are there questions? Representative Heigerken and then Egan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, Superintendents, Representative Sikora, I will debate each and every one of the points you made here. First of all, in regards to teacher salaries, your districts represent the highest salaries in the state of Minnesota. I'm sure there's a long waiting line of people trying to get there. I can take you up to Red Lake, and there's not many people lined up to teach there. Housing, in regards to housing, I have a problem. My district is that the teachers from Melrose and Albany all seem to live in St. Cloud, even though houses are higher. So that's kind of, opposite. I'm contradicting what you just said. I'd like to have a house, $350,000, worth of $350,000, whether it be in Edina or St. Louis Park or not. The thing is, they probably built that house at $150,000, and you've just seen the $200,000 it's better than putting money in the bank. At the same time, I can take you out to Tremont, where people have bought houses for $100,000, they can't sell them for $30,000. That's the problem you have in rural Minnesota. It doesn't go up, it goes down when you sell your houses. So it's a good investment. Housing is a good investment. True, that's one of the leading causes of higher salaries, but you do get your money back. In regards to referendums, I'll go to your district and look at the qualities of facilities you have. I'll talk about Edina building a dome football stadium for the football players.
We are not.
And I'll take you out to rural Minnesota, and they're cutting football. I've got headlines over here for Bonanza Valley Voice Bulletin today. And it says, board dumps local school lunch program, but approves superintendent's raise. This is the headlines I'm getting from my district, but I'm just going to go back and revisit 2001 tax reform bill and explain to you how it affects rural Minnesota. The tax bill there basically took the high-value property homes along Lake Minnewaska and Levin and Amelia, etc. We try to pass a school bond if they're exempt from all school referendums. Those are the most valuable prices of property in our district, and they're not subject to any school bond issue. In trade-off, it's true you gave some of the farmlands. Basically, they are taxed only on 3.5 acres. Their property tax is exempt. So we would have a difficult time passing a referendum. They have to go to Glenwood, Starbuck, where they have retired people that are living on Social Security, and they're living in 70,000 houses. And it has to be spread over those few people and a few businesses that we have out there. That's what you call reality, a very, very difficult time of passing a referendum because, and it failed and failed and failed because these retired people don't want to pay for it. So that's very, my point being is I'm just basically refuting some of the testimony that I gave here. And any answer to any of that, I'll...
Superintendent Drake.
Yes, I just want to clarify one. We are not building a dome stadium in Edina, so where you've heard that, I'm not sure, but that's not there. We also, I think the state of Minnesota has done a very good job of providing equity in facilities around the state. We build all our facilities basically with our taxpayer dollars. The state of Minnesota, there are some very nice facilities, and I've traveled all over the state, as you have, And there are some very nice facilities out state. I'm very happy about that. And I'm happy that students in whatever community, the state can make up some equity funding so that those facilities can be built. In actuality, the age of our buildings are older. We have no building less than 30 years old, and that cannot be said in many communities in the state of Minnesota. For the equity, the issue is here, I think, in terms of what should go into the funding formula. And I think a lot of effort has been put in the last number of years to try to look at what are differential costs. And I think compensatory aid, I think disparity aid, there's two disparity categories. We deal with immigration aid, we deal with, and that happens all over the state of Minnesota. All of those things are occurring. But again, this is one, you know that there is difference in what it costs to live in a different community, and I don't think it's been addressed by the state.
Madam Chair,
Superintendent
Peters. May I respond a little bit? I personally grew up in a rural area. I've been a superintendent in rural areas in Minnesota, so I appreciate many of the points you've made. But I also recognize that school districts are not going to change the reality of what it costs to live in various parts of our state. It does cost more to live and work in the metropolitan area generally. And there are some other regions that are also have high costs. And so what we're asking is that the state formula for distribution of resources to schools recognize that fact. What other policies you implement to affect the cost of various factors that go into that is beyond our reach, and maybe even beyond the reach of the legislature, because it's driven pretty much by our economy. But we're simply asking for a recognition of the fact that these cost differences are impacting children in our classrooms very negatively.
Thank you. We have several questions, and I'm going to limit it to these questions, and then we're going to move on to the next bill. But I think this number of people that are going to be questioned will probably express all of the committee's concerns. Eakin, Representative Eakin, you're next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, it seems that the focal point has been on those differentials which cost more in the metropolitan area, but it seems that a lot of things aren't being taken into consideration. Representative Heidgerken did refer to the fact that, you know, housing in rural Minnesota is not increasing in value. It's not really an investment out there like it is in the metropolitan area. I think that was a very good point. And there are many other factors that are not taken into consideration. I live in rural Minnesota, and I can tell you that gas costs the same. I can tell you that groceries are more expensive in my small town than they are in the city. I can tell you that college education for my children will probably be the same, and we'll actually take a larger percentage of incomes from people in rural Minnesota because they don't earn as much. So I'm wondering, were you taking into consideration all of these other costs and all of these other living expenses, or were you simply looking at housing, which I think Representative Heidgerken made quite clear is actually an investment here in the metropolitan area?
Representative Sebring, I don't believe when we look at the organization, the department that does the cost differential, that only looks at salaries, various salaries for services. It does not look at housing costs. Mm-hmm. I mentioned housing costs because in my district, housing is just skyrocketing, and many people who would like to teach in Minnetonka can't even afford a house in the area. I mean, it is getting kind of out of hand, but it is not part of the education index. So you don't have to worry about that being counted. I would say housing might be a great investment in my area, but you know what? If you can't afford the payments, you can't do it at all. You can't even get a house.
Representative Cedar, and I think what we're really in this proposal not putting in the cost of families in a community. We're talking about cost of providing education in those communities. And the state has done many things to help the cost of the districts that I mentioned earlier, those who have over $8,000 revenue, over $7,000 revenue, or the other 42 over $6,000 revenue. Practically all of those are in rural Minnesota. Mm-hmm. So I think the legislature has made some adjustments in terms of what it costs to do education in those rural areas, and we are simply saying make some adjustments to what it costs to do education in high-cost communities.
Superintendent Peterson.
Madam Chair, the one point that I'd like to glean out of those comparisons that Mr. Kroonquist presented is the 31% cost of labor outside of education. Those are basically free market driven factors, that it does cost more for employees and other businesses in the metro versus the non-metro area. That's not to say that our cost should be similar. It's simply to point out that wages costs do exist, differences do exist, and that there should be a search for us to find those factors that are most prevalent and driving differences in educational costs, because we do face those same pressures. It's not just that we pay our teachers more than outstate. All employees in the metropolitan area mm-hmm. have higher average pay than non-metro areas.
Representative Eakin, did you have a follow-up?
Yeah, I guess I just wanted to thank you, Madam Chair. Just follow up. As far as the higher cost due to higher wages and salaries, it seems to me, again, in rural Minnesota, we don't earn the kinds of incomes. That's true. And I think you point out a very important problem. And I think that the problem is that in rural Minnesota, the incomes aren't adequate, I think, in many cases. And that applies to education as well, because we do have many of the same costs, whether it be gas, groceries, college education, what have you. So we get hit much harder as a result of that lower salaries. So I think that we should be addressing it, I guess, more from that side. And I would ask if one of the reasons that salaries for teachers in the metropolitan area are so much higher is simply because there's more money here to pay them what they truly deserve, rather than out in rural areas where we have a very small tax base. And I think that's the problem in rural Minnesota.
Superintendent Drake.
Thank you, Representative Seagrin. I think in the research that we did, the cost differential basically is more a factor of increased training. More of our teachers are master's. When we look at the years of experience, there's not much differential. And there's some data we'll give you. There's not much differential in cost between teachers of experience outstate and teachers of experience in the metropolitan area. Where you find a major difference is when you go up into the master's degree, master's plus. And so teachers at the higher end make more money. But the average starting salary, for example, between metro and outstate is very similar, probably within $2,000 to $3,000. And yet you've still got a 20% differential for that new teacher to start working in a metropolitan area. So the basic difference in salaries is really the amount of staff that you have, because right or wrong, we have steps and lanes. And the steps going to across from our experience is what's driving those salaries up in major in what I want to call regional centers and in the metropolitan area.
Just one quick comment, if I could.
Senator.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. And I think, again, one of the reasons there are more teachers with master's degrees working probably in the metropolitan area is because the school districts here can afford to hire teachers with master's degree more easily.
Well, I don't know that. Excuse me, sir. I'm not sure that based on the, mm-hmm. the if I get $8,000, like some school districts do in the state of Minnesota, instead of $6,000, I could hire a lot more teachers also. But I don't. But there must be a reason that some districts are getting $8,000 and districts like ours are getting less than $6,000. So I think that would, I'd have to look into that more carefully. But how do you spend your money, I think, is based on what your community wants you to spend it on with money that you're able to get from the state and local referendum.
Representative Biskins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To testify, Superintendents, Representative Sikora, I thank you for bringing these numbers forward. It looks like a reasoned issue and one that should be dealt with. I do understand how some of our outstate friends right away get their dander up. But I think the one chart that is absolutely the most telling is the chart on page 5, the bottom chart, which simply looks at what percent of your salary goes into housing. That's a huge issue. That is probably the most telling chart. And I would like, you know, our rural folk to just kind of look at that a little bit, because that's so important. I have two questions. Number one, to Representative Sikora. Now, I understand the bill being brought forward, and it's very principle in nature, right? It's an idea that needs to be looked at. I guess I'm wondering why you would skew that idea by adding on page 2, lines 5 and 6, that the education price index for each school equals the greater of 1, i.e., if we're talking about principal and we really want to stand with the principal, why are you setting a baseline of 1? All right? There are some places, and we've heard, where actually the price index is going down. Why aren't we being true and honest to that? So that's question 1. And then question number 2, this would be to Superintendent Dreg. Seth, probably have you had an opportunity to make a presentation to the governor's task force on education funding, and could you share with us what kind of response you've had?
You go ahead. Superintendent Drake.
Thank you, Representative Segrin. The information on cost differentials has been presented to the education the governor's task force on educational finance, and we're optimistic that in the final draft of that, that will be one of the considerations.
And I guess I still have to answer a question, Madam Chair. Representative Biskins, I wanted to do this very fairly. I know there are a lot of formulas out there which take care of a lot of different issues. We are not suggesting getting rid of any of the formulas. And I'm also a realist. And I know that unless we set the base at 1 so nobody loses anything, we will never pass anything like this. So you've always got to do it in a way so that nobody loses, which is, you know, kind of the way we do many things around here. I don't want anybody to lose money on this, but I do think it's very important that we add this to our little bucket of special formulas, because it does make a big difference.
Yeah.
Our huge bucket, our water tank full of special formulas.
Representative
Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a quick comment, and I appreciate that very much. And you know, a sage legislator in my freshman year told me one of the problems with trying to enact reform in government is it's so gosh darn expensive. And this is probably indicative of that.
Yes, Representative Biskin. Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Sikora, have you done runs based on this bill?
Representative Sikora.
No, we have not done runs, but we have made, you know, the comparisons that you saw, which gives you some idea. And there are, you know, other districts represented in this room that would benefit from that, and there are other districts that would probably stay at 1, because for right now their costs are not higher. There are also, though, a number, I think, of districts outstate that would benefit from this that, you know, we just don't have those numbers, but I know Mr. Kroonquist said that they've seen some of those numbers at AMSD.
The point is, Representative Erickson, no one would get less money under this.
Right, I realize that. Yeah. Yes, and Madam Chair, and Mr. Kroonquist, perhaps it is, you know, the Metro Region 11 and my Region 7E and next door to me 7W that would benefit most from this, or I don't know if anyone wants to answer that.
Mr. Kroonquist.
If there is a benefit.
Madam Chair and Representative Erickson, it's difficult to say because as the bill drafted, it requires the Commissioner, of Education and mm-hmm. Economic Security to work mm-hmm. together to establish mm-hmm. those regions.
Okay.
And so we would need to know the regions before you would really be able to determine exactly who would.
And Madam Chair, one last question to the superintendents. Thank you, Madam Chair. Either superintendent, would it be better for us to have major funding reform than to probably look at these different, what I would call, Band-Aids along the way? And I know you mentioned the task force.
Superintendent Peterson?
Madam Chair, Representative Erickson, yes, I think it would be a benefit, mm-hmm. but this is a factor that should get on the agenda.
Oh, okay.
And I think, as Dr. Dykstra indicated, the task force is likely to consider this and perhaps include it. But I think the goal here should be for the legislature to send a message about the importance of this factor and that it be considered as a major element in reforming how we distribute resources to students.
Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Secor and superintendents, in the words of Representative Biskins, my dander is up. I question just about every tenant that you're bringing up, with the exception of housing. If anything, I have to refrain myself from getting excited about too many things. I couldn't write fast enough of the thoughts I had in terms of metro versus non-metro districts. Cost of textbooks, paper and pens, janitorial supplies, sports supplies, buses, fuel, any equipment, I don't think there's any difference in where you're located, the cost of all those things. So I think we pretty much agree that the cost of housing is probably the single biggest thing which affects teachers' ability to come in and whether they make a wage to buy a house that's in your area. Question I have is, do you have trouble filling teaching positions in your schools?
Superintendent Peterson.
Madam Chair, Representative Demmer. We do have some problems, but I would have to tell you in general, relatively, we don't have trouble filling our positions. However, because of the bargaining laws of the state and the economic pressures, we still have to pay more for teachers in our system than we would in an outstate district. And we've tried to point out those economic pressures, housing being a major one of those factors. For any one of us, housing is a major factor. And teacher salaries is the major factor in any of our funding. Supplies are a small part of what we spend our money on. It's mainly salaries.
Representative
Emmer. Madam Chair, for the positions you do have trouble filling, would you say the major reason that you have trouble filling those is because you can't pay them enough? Do they go someplace else because of the, do they not come to your schools because of the wages you're able to pay?
Superintendent Peterson.
Madam Chair, and Dr. Dykstra may have more to add to this. I think when we look at being able to hire teachers, we have to look at are we getting the overall quality of teacher in our state that we should be, which is another whole can of worms. But our ability to hire people is not necessarily related to our ability to hire outstanding people. And I would suggest to you that in the nearly 30 years I've worked in Minnesota, that equation has changed dramatically over that time. And so, yeah, we can fill positions that are open. Those that we have trouble with are just because people are not available in those fields in particular.
Representative Demmer, last question, because we have one more questioner, and then we're going to move on to the next bill.
Okay, Madam Chair, thank you. I don't disagree that in terms of the profession, I think that's true for all districts all around the state. I'm talking about being able to hire relative to other school districts. I can tell you that in the non-metro areas, such as what I represent, we can't hire oftentimes because we can't pay relative to a school district someplace else, such as yourself. And I would venture to say also that keeping teachers, you don't lose teachers to non-metro schools because of wages, regardless of, they find a way to make it work. But my conjecture is that you don't not fill teachers' positions because you lose them to non-metro places because of salaries. And I would also venture a guess that you don't lose teachers to non-metro school districts because of salaries. And again, we're talking relative to non-metro. We're not talking about the industry in general. We're talking about relative to non-metro, because that's what you're talking about here, is saying that you deserve more money relative to non-metro because you need to pay your teachers. I would suggest it's quite the opposite.
Representative Demmer, I think one of the things that happens, though, in the metropolitan area is that they lose teachers to the private sector. They're competing with the private sector. But I think sometimes in the non-metro area, you'll find that the teacher salary is probably the area where you have the highest salary in that community versus other private sector jobs, and so they become probably one of the better paid persons in your community, whereas in the metropolitan area, a teacher is in relationship to the other private sector jobs and trying to keep them retained. You have a different relationship. Superintendent Drakeset?
Yeah, Representative Dimmer. I grew up in South Dakota, which borders Minnesota on the west side, in a small community, and my dad was on the school board there, and we continually lost teachers to western Minnesota that paid higher salaries and were perceived a better place to go. And we lost them because students wanted to, or teachers wanted to go to, obviously where there were more income, but they also wanted to go to some of those communities that looked very desirable. So it's not very different than the western Minnesota teacher moving into the metropolitan area because they're a young, young person wanting to move in to Metro for a lot of different reasons. So it works both ways, I think.
Representative Goodwin, you'll be the last questioner because we need to move. We've got two more bills.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to ask, as I look at these numbers here that Mr. Kronquist gave us, I don't see the districts split out. I just see the region split out, and I want to make the comment that there's a huge difference between teacher salaries in different districts and within the metropolitan area. And I also want to make the point that, do you have those numbers? First of all, I want to ask you if you have those numbers of the teacher salaries split out by district, the average teacher salaries in the metro area.
Madam Chair, Representative Goodwin, not here, but I think that's certainly...
I think that's important to this bill.
That would probably be good to give that out.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just one more comment. I would like to see. I would like you to look at the fact that in the metro area we have a lot more housing options than they do for cost of housing options than the rural areas do. So I don't know that that's a good measure, the cost of housing in the areas that you're living in and trying to hire teachers in. But I also wanted to just make the statement that I think if you supported the statewide health plan, you could cut some of your costs too. And I know the superintendents are not doing that in general. And I would just say that that might be a good way to save some money instead of doing what we're doing here.
All right. If Mr. Kronquist, did you have any comments
before
you
Madam Chair.
Okay.
It raises a lot of different issues, and the discussion veers off into housing, et cetera. Bottom line, what we're trying to get at is the cost of doing business to a school district, not what it costs a family to live in different parts of the state, what it costs for a school district to function in a different part of the state. That's really the issue, and I think the facts speak pretty loud and clear that there is a cost of doing a business difference primarily related to wages. And this proposal, as I tried to mention at the outset, in no way are we saying that there should be less revenue going to Representative Demers students or Representative Eakin students. And we recognize sparsity and other cost drivers in those areas. We think we should. This is just another cost driver that school districts really can't do anything about. It's really beyond their control. It has to do with laws of supply and demand and market forces. But they're there, and we're not currently addressing them. So we want to work, with all of you, including rural legislators, to find a solution here that we think is equitable for all of our students.
Thank you. All right. We want to go on to House File 1846.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Sakura. Representative Olson's bill. I don't know, members, how good a presentation Representative Olson will be making today, since she's a new mother and she's... had a lot of no sleep, and so we have to maybe treat her a little bit more kindly here today. Representative Olson, you ready?
Yes. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House File 1846.
All right. 1846 is before our committee for
consideration on this bill.
Mm-hmm.
As the agenda says, House File 1846 convenes a working group to recommend how best to develop and deliver a preparation program for school administrators who, as credentialed as a new turnaround specialist, are trained to successfully implement educational and business principles to turn around the performance of consistently low-performing schools. And I just want to start out by saying this is my desire is for this not to be a bashing blow of any kind, but to be positive direction for all public schools. Consistently low-performing schools can benefit from having a principal with a proven track record turning around chronically troubled schools. For that reason, House File 1846 creates a working group to make recommendations back to the legislature next February for school principals to serve as turnaround specialists in consistently low-performing schools. The premise of this bill is that we need to identify people who have the skills and experience, give them added turnaround specialist training, and have them available to go in and turn around a chronically low-performing school. This bill is one of two that I got the idea from Governor Warner, a young entrepreneur governor of Virginia, when I was at a conference this summer with Representative Nelson on a scholarship. I was very impressed with many of his reforms, and his staff have been very helpful at working with my office and others in House Research and stuff in creating a bill similar to his that would be applicable in Minnesota. House File 1846 aims at creating a training program for up to 10 school administrators in the first year and an additional 10 in the following year. This would result in a turnaround specialist credential. Each turnaround specialist will serve as a principal of a low-performing school for a minimum of 3 years. If we're credentialing them, we want to give them time to be successful in that new school building. The working group consists of representatives of the four-year post-secondary institutions, school principals, business organizations, school boards, K-12 full-time public school classroom teachers who are currently in the classroom, and I was very specific on that because those are the teachers that would be impacted by such a principal. It's school business officials and school administrators, so it's a pretty straightforward group of stakeholders. It directs the Education Commissioner and the Board of School Administrators to submit the working group recommendations to the legislature, as I said, by February 2005, so next February. House File 1846 outlines some specifics, hoping that their recommendations include training focused on successful business and education strategies that have proven effective in turning around low-performing organizations, that it include proven business management strategies such as effective organizational management, finance, and accounting practices, restructuring and renewal of troubled organizations, turnaround in crisis management in business and education law. The initiative further intends that turnaround specialists work under a contract with a local school system so it maintains the local control over this oversight, and with the goals that they set, responsibilities, goals, and measurements for success of the turnaround specialists that they're employing. Under Virginia's proposal, I might add, there are several ways schools may employ a turnaround specialist, so have a turnaround specialist come in, by expressing an interest in such services as a potential requirement due to consistent failure in meeting the state and federal education accountability measures, and three, as a result of significant parental request, which meet the specific guidelines that they had established by their state Board of Education. So with that, again, I ask for your support in inclusion in the honors bill, and I'll take any questions.
Representative Olson, just one question. There is an organization that is not on here that I might suggest. I got an email late yesterday afternoon. I didn't have a chance to alert you to it. But the Minnesota Academic Excellence Foundation does exactly this kind of work. With the Baldrige model, of course, that's a model that looks at business principles and looks at, you know, kind of the best practices for actually doing some of this work. And they might be somebody that would be an excellent addition to some kind of a working group. And so I would suggest that you might consider adding them.
Certainly, that's a good suggestion.
The list. Are there any questions for Representative Olson? Is there anyone in the Representative Erickson? And then if there's anyone in the audience who wants to make a comment, feel free to come up. Otherwise, Representative Erickson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Olson, would this just be a working group that would work with principals, or could there be teachers who wanted to try this kind of challenge, or outsiders, you know, from outside the educational arena?
I believe at this point that it would be strictly principals, because they already have that certification, and this is going beyond that to give them additional training.
Representative Olson, just one more question. This would be people that can seek, you know, they might establish this kind of turnaround specialist. Once they get it, though, it's just basically a school district or superintendent and board can, you know, seek to hire someone like this with that credential, or someone within their existing school district could seek it, and then they could use them in different ways, too.
That's correct, Madam Chair. It would help them identify these specialists as certified through the state.
Okay. All right. Representative Mariani.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Olson, I think generally this is a pretty good idea, but my question is, do we need legislation to have the commissioner do this? Couldn't the commissioner simply put together a working group that can issue recommendations about a possible certification program and send us recommendations as a legislature on things to think about in terms of helping the kind of schools you want to help with this?
Representative Olson.
Madam Chair, Representative Mariani, you raise good points. However, I don't know if it is at the top of her agenda to do such a thing, and I think the time is coming that we really do need to look at an extra certification for such specialists to help these chronically poor-performing schools, because it's in the best interest of the students that attend those schools. And, you know, as President Bush and others look at, you know, students' ability to leave schools, we want to look at how to improve those existing schools, not just allow students to, you know, the option of leaving the school. So I think the timeliness is such that I want to make sure it's on the radar right now as all these changes are coming down, so we're ready to have these specialists come in.
Representative Mariani.
Madam Chair, just two very quick comments. Then one is I was recently at a sort of a workshop with Cargill-funded schools, and they brought in an excellent administrator out of Colorado who led a discussion on precisely this kind of stuff, and he's doing some phenomenal work with a public charter school in Colorado. And so on page 2 in the language, you know, between lines 10 and 15, we talk about management strategies, finance and accounting practices, restructuring troubled organizations, crisis management, business and education law. The key thing that this gentleman shared with us was that the important indicator for success for him was...
Excuse me. Can the people in the back take their conversation out? It's getting so noisy that we really cannot hear the representative asking his questions and make his comments.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. The key thing he shared with us was that the most dynamic thing that that they did in their school, and that he consults with others, is to create a strong staff-led process where, you know, really appealing to all the reasons why people go into teaching in the first place. And so, just something for you to think about in terms of, you know, some additional sort of indicators of what would make sort of a turnaround specialist might be, you know, language related to being able to lead a teacher-driven process. And then, Madam Chair, I suspect that this will probably cost something. Is it the intent then to think about this in terms of the finance, possible finance?
Yeah, I was just asking Mr. Crow if there was a fiscal note. Representative Olson, do you expect a fiscal note with this?
Madam Chair, I'll try to answer both questions. That question first. Not that there would be a working group fiscal note, but I think it's before your committee because such a certification, depending on where it came through, private organization, or, you know, colleges, or if it came through the department, is in, I think what Virginia is doing is it's going right, the certification is going through the department, then it may have a fiscal note. But I, it's not my impression, that, or nor have I heard that there's a fiscal note on the working group. It's pretty much a volunteer working group.
And we probably will need to maybe talk to the Board of Administration. Have they made comments on this? Or
they have not, Madam Chair, but I'm out of the country. So
well, that's true. Yeah.
But my assistant has not said that they have comments.
Okay. So we'll probably touch base with them to see about, you know, their, I'm sure they would probably be interested in this. And I don't see anybody right now. I saw Charlie Kite from the superintendents, but I don't see anybody here from the principals today.
And Madam Chair, can I answer?
Yes, Representative
Mary, on a second other question. For that reason is why I wanted to explicitly outline, I worked a long time with Lisa Larson and getting the ranges correctly, that one of the members must be the class 5 kindergarten through grade 12 full-time public school teachers currently teaching in a K-12 classroom. We were pretty specific there that they would have the input for such a proposal, because I agree with you and Cargill that that's critical.
Representative Wardlow, and that will be the last question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just, Representative, I noticed that on line, page 2, lines 4 and 5 and 6, it talks about these training principals are placed as principals for a minimum of 3 school years, so I'm assuming they would replace the current principal in a low-performing school, and is that up to the superintendent or where he wants to put that?
It would be up to, at this point, it's my intention, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Representative Roybal, mm-hmm. but out of practice, it would be my intention as the author that it would be up to the local superintendent and school board.
All right. All right. Thank you, Representative Olson. And we'll move on to our last bill, House File 2402, Representative Abler. Go ahead. And
thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move House File 2402 for a certain inclusion in the omnibus bill.
For certain inclusion?
It seems to paying attention. The bill about acoustics, I'm seeing if you can hear what I'm saying.
What?
Madam Chair, the point you made about the audience making some noise actually provides, I couldn't have offered a better way to back up this whole bill. Some students that have a little difficulty in hearing when there's a little extra noise going around cannot function well in a classroom. And it's the whole focus of this bill to give those students that fair opportunity to accomplish their mission of learning there. So with that brief introduction, I'll turn it over to my witnesses who will offer you their thoughts.
Madam Chair, Representative Abler, and committee members, I'd like to thank you. My name is Mary Hartnett. I'm with the Minnesota Commission Serving Deaf and Hard of Hearing People. We're a 15-member governor-appointed commission that's charged with advocating for equal rights to services for deaf, hard of hearing, deaf-blind children and adults. We recently completed a strategic plan, and one of the priorities of the commission is to look at the educational outcomes of deaf, hard of hearing, and deaf-blind kids. Studies, national studies show that deaf and hard of hearing children are graduating with third to fourth grade reading levels, and one of the strategies that we wanted to look at when we were approaching overcoming these dismal outcomes was getting this bill passed, which would also have a positive impact on all children in the classroom. This bill would amend the school safety standards and require that school districts submit a plan that follows the National Acoustic, American National Institute's Acoustical Standards Association guidelines for classroom acoustics for all new construction and major innovation. And why should this happen? Well, there's two major reasons. First, it will improve learning outcomes for children, and secondly, it will save money in the long run for school districts. No Child Left Behind has presented enormous challenges to the state, and standards are being developed and resources are being spent to improve outcomes in the classroom. But even before teachers open their mouth, there are a lot of barriers that they have when they're in the classroom. Many of the children that are in the classroom, the background noise is so great that they can't hear the teacher in the back of the room. Studies in Ohio have shown that over 90% of schools exceed recommended decibel levels of 35 or above. You need to have the background noise have a what's called a signal-to-noise ratio. That's the background noise. The speaker has to have a 15 decibel level higher than the background noise in the classroom. And the study showed that about 90% of the schools fail to meet that standard. There are children in every class, though totally unaware of it themselves, cannot hear or understand the spoken message well. This has a very significant impact on learning, ability to pay attention, and reading scores. And I'm not just talking about the kids with hearing loss. I'm talking about all children. All children need good acoustics to understand familiar words and to learn new information. With the handout that I provided, it's called Attachment 2. There is a picture. At the bottom it says page 6, and at the top it says Attachment 2. There are three pictures that depict three different classrooms that have students in them or learners that are struggling in the classroom. The first, I'll just walk you through figure 4A. First is a classroom that has 17, a second grade classroom that has 17 students in it. They're working quietly and independently, and the teacher is walking through giving instruction. There is a time trace in the sound wave meter that you can see, and over a 10-minute period. And it shows that the background noise in the classroom, because of the heating and ventilation and air conditioning unit, has a background noise of 62 decibels. And the teacher's voice range typically is between 50 to 60 decibel level. So there's a zero signal-to-noise ratio. The noise, background noise, is as loud as the teacher's voice in that classroom. And we expect that the children in this age range are not able to hear the information in the classroom. The other two examples are examples from the fourth grade, fifth grade, that have similar results. What causes the noise and the reverberation? It can be heating and ventilation and air conditioning equipment, noise from adjacent rooms and hallways. Classroom noise can be made worse because of poor design and poor materials. More than 30 years ago, a researcher did the first study on this subject and found that students in a school in New York City were a year behind in reading if they were on the side of the building where a train was running by. That same researcher found that when the noise was reduced a few years later, the reading abilities of students on the formerly noisy side of the school improved. Numerous studies have followed in the subsequent 30 years, and they all show a minimum of reading delays of 3 months to 4 months to up to 2 years because of the noisy classroom environment. Children who have hearing loss, English language learners, and those with attention problems need even more favorable acoustics. We know that there are large numbers of hard of hearing children in schools. Many children now have ear infections with identification of newborn hearing screen. There's more kids that have been identified in the schools, but many not identified who have a hearing loss and don't even know it because of ear infections. When children do have a hearing loss, they are significantly affected by this background noise. In many school districts, there are large numbers of children who are English language learners. A recent study that was done at Jefferson School in Minneapolis studied two groups of children. One was a group of children that were spoke English, another spoke Spanish. When they were in a quiet room, all the children could identify all the words that were said in that classroom. When the noise level was increased in the classroom from 10, that 15 signal-to-noise ratio, just to 10, the children that spoke Spanish only were unable to recognize 50% of those words. So it has a big impact on those kids. There's also been studies that have been done on kids with ADHD, and it shows that there's increased distractibility, reduced attention, and increased impulsivity amongst those kids. And what's the solution to this? Well, there's a new acoustic standard that has been developed over the course of the last 4 years, and my colleague, Mike Dixon here, was part of that acoustical standards board. And you have an article that was also distributed, Peggy Nelson, who's a professor at the University of Minnesota, who's going to be presenting a lot of this information today, was unable to come. And it specifies that noise levels in core learning spaces should not exceed a 35 decibel level, that their materials be chosen that help to improve the acoustics in the classroom, and that absorptive materials will reduce the negative impacts of the reverberation, and to require quieter HVAC systems or heating, ventilation, and air conditioning systems. The estimated cost of this will be a half a percentage point, half percent more for new construction, and it's pegged at an average of 3% more. U.S. Access Board has said it could be up to 5% more. Major renovation costs are more difficult to estimate. U.S. Access Board, a federal agency committed to accessible design, did a study, and they tracked how many kids would be impacted by not being able to hear in the classroom. And the cost of supports that those children would need, and they said that over the course of 20 years, those special costs would be averaged out of, you know, over 12,000 kids would be about $225 per child. If a school is built from scratch using these standards, the added costs are about $7.50 per child. Right now, the University of Minnesota has adopted these standards. Before these standards were developed, the Minneapolis Public School System started to develop their own and is following those, and we hope the rest of the state will follow suit. A list of national organizations is attached to this handout. The board, I think it was Michael explained, is very well represented by people from the building industry, teachers, parents, who are really trying to grapple with this problem. We urge you to pass this bill. These standards will come at some additional cost in the short run, but will ultimately prove to be a wise decision on your part as we move forward with new construction.
Thank you. We only have about 5 or 7 minutes left, and before we move on, one of the things about this bill is that this requires the health and safety levy to start paying for these acoustical situations. We don't pay for new buildings and major renovations out of the health and safety levy. And I think that there's a more appropriate way to handle this than the health and safety levy. But I think we do need to hear from the department on this issue as far as the costs, because if we do it in a different way and we anticipate new building, we also have to anticipate debt service aid and levy costs that will be part of this. And if your background is right, 1 to 2% of an increase in our debt is a major financial issue for us. So I just want to make that, maybe that's good enough to say at this point. And why don't we go ahead and just have your testifiers, and then we'll conclude the day.
My name is Michael Nixon. I'm president of EA Acoustical Engineering and president of the Classroom Acoustics Special Interest Group. I'm a member of the Acoustical Society of America, associate member of the Educational Audiology Association, Self-Help for Hard of Hearing. I've been an advocate for over 10 years and was a working member of the American National Standards Institute that developed the national standards. Insofar as additional cost is concerned, with some 30-odd years in the construction business, and I perceive that buildings, school buildings, are built as a matter of form over function rather than function over form. There is nothing more important than good acoustics in a school. The school was developed to develop an educational process by listening and speaking, and both those elements are highly dependent on the acoustics and noise control. As far as the acoustics and the attachment to reducing reverberation, it's quite possible that the cost is nothing, since form over function frequently results in materials being selected based on appearance rather than performance. As far as the HVAC is concerned, that can be tackled. Yes, it's a little more expensive, but not insurmountable if the priorities are placed on good acoustics in the classroom.
Madam Chair, my name is Patty Teachout, and last year I was here at the Capitol to ask for support for the hearing aid bill for children birth to 18, and that was my first time involved in the legislative process. And that bill passed and has changed my son's life significantly. He is now in the classroom at grade level, and it is important to me that he be able to hear what his teacher says in his classroom. Children who are deaf or hard of hearing are graduating with third or fourth grade reading levels, and passing this bill would help many of those children. But it's not just the deaf and hard of hearing kids, it's all kids that would benefit from this. I have now become a member of the Minnesota Commission Serving Deaf and Hard of Hearing People because I want to continue to fight for what's best for the children. I know that schools in the state are scrambling to figure out ways to improve outcomes, to close the achievement gap, and here's a way you can do it. As a taxpayer and a mom with children in public school system, I urge you to pass this bill. Let's stop building schools that kids can't hear in and build schools where they can learn, listen, and achieve. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have actually 1 minute for questions. Anybody have a question? Representative Krenke.
Did you look at what we use here, a simple amplification system, rather than spending hundreds of millions of dollars trying to retrofit schools?
Amplification does not resolve the problem. Amplification in an existing noisy environment means you have to turn up the amplification, and then you get spillover into other spaces, and you just exacerbate the problem. Increasing the signal does not necessarily result in greater clarity, and in fact can result in the ability of those with communications-related problems not being able to hear as well as perhaps without amplification. I should mention that in terms of costs, it's the local taxpayers that fund the construction of schools. What is needed is a clear criteria from the school board or the decision-making body to the architects, because unless architects are given specific direction, good acoustics in 99% of the cases just ain't going to happen.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, first of all, obviously we all know that the state does pay for a portion of cost of school construction, and certainly pays for a portion of renovation cost of construction. So the idea, and obviously we've seen this numerous times where somebody says it's just a minor cost. I think anyone who knows anything about ADA knows that it's cost hundreds of millions of dollars in renovation costs to buildings, quote unquote, bring them up to code. And some of the standards there, you constantly hear about the standards and what those standards mean and what they mean in terms of construction and truly whether they, to what extent and what benefit they provide. So obviously we want to provide good classrooms. I'm not sure this is the way to do it.
Representative Abler, why don't you wind up your bill?
Thanks, Madam Chair. I appreciate your attention to the topic. I think 1% or 2% of a large number is still a large number, so this is not a free deal. But at least if you call attention to the issue and design better, it can be a better product for very little increased cost. At least think about it, and there's some ways that might cost money that make sense. So thank you for your good attention and your time.
Thank you so much. This meeting is adjourned.